Then he said that some of us, it is true, a few, may have gone out of Egypt with Israel, but he said the fact remained that we left from time to time, and most of our numbers were out in the hill country and over into the ages. Now, he said that Jews are not to be considered as a race apart from all other people. And then he proves that, and he uses Columbia University, which he's a graduate in Cornell, to prove that. He says, you see, there are races, Negro, Mongolian, Oriental, and white. But the strange thing is about the so-called Jewish race of people, we are found yellow, black, and white scattered all over the world. There are white Jews, black Jews, yellow Jews, and as he talks about them, he cites here that we have been mixed up with everybody on the face of the earth, but very few of us have in any way, any blood, except where we have mixed with the whites, that are Israel. Now he says, strangely, the Zionist calls the individual who's opposed to what's going on anti-Semite. And the man who doesn't like his Jewish neighbor is probably more Israelitish than the neighbor. That's what he says here. Well, I'll go along with that. That we're not mad at Israel. We just don't like Israel alive. Now, when a man admits this, he says, now, none of the 10 lost tribes are Jews. We don't know exactly where they are. The Anglo-Saxon people claim to be them. How he knows that. And Queen Victoria can trace her ancestry right back to the tribe of David. He said the Anglo-Saxons are more Israel than all the Jews in the earth. And he said there was some consistency. He said there was some consistency with Adolf Hitler, which he despises. Hitler said to a German, either you're a Jew, to a Czech you're a Jew, to a Pole you're a Jew, to a Frenchman you're a Jew. Or he said to a German, where once a German, you're always a German. Or if you're a real Pole, you're a Pole. But it didn't make any difference to what country a Jew belongs. Hitler said, you're a Jew. Well, I'm going to tell you something. Hitler was right. Not maybe in everything, but he was right when he said, you're a Jew, because he just got through admitting you could be white, black, or yellow. But one thing first, you're a Jew. But the people, the white race, can be German, American, Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, or all the white races combined has made America what it is, where Israel gathered in one place. Now, when the Rehoboam's administration was ruined by these Hittites, Canaanites, Jebusites, and what have you here, that all had that hooked nose that marked who they were, he's unable to explain one thing. He says that conversion to Babylonian Judaism, which was a type of religion that had adopted some of the doctrines of Israel in order to have a theological front for their nationalist ambitions. That's what he said here. Converted people of all races. The only thing is that there was a gradual strain of the amalgamation of these people that gave them a sort of racial mark, and they married a lot of their converters. Now, you can say all you want to about Jewry just being a religion, but that doesn't account for the look on their face. So you see, it does cross the line. But I'm glad to have Mr. Alfred Lilienthal, even pink-side as he is, come out and admit that all the Jews are not, none of the Jews are Abraham's seed, and then come out and admit that they're black Jews, yellow Jews, white Jews, and to tell us where they came from. Not often that a Jew will sit down and tell you where he came from. He says, we come from Bulgar, the Pastars, the Jebusites, the Canaanites, the Amalekites, the Ammonites, and every one of those people are people God told Israel, don't you let them come into your land or marry your sons and daughters. So since he admits they're that people, he can't blame us for saying, keep your race pure and don't absorb them. Because that's what the Lord said. Now, remember that Jeroboam, leading the northern 10 tribes, or city-states of Israel, and Benjamin was probably represented there too that time, but certain geographical factors and divine destiny kept Benjamin from acting independently, came down and said to Rehoboam, as we mentioned to you several months ago in another message, If you don't, will you lighten our taxes lighter than your father Solomon when all his building campaign? And the answer was, they'd have to come back tomorrow for their answer. And so the wise men said, Rehoboam, you better lighten the taxes and keep the people happy, not spend so much and squander it. Turn around, and all the New Deal administrators spoke to him. Says, why, just keep on increasing the taxes, make more bureaus, spend more money, involve the nation in more and more, and tell them this. If your father whips them with whips, you'll whip them with scorpions. If thy father's arm was heavy, thy little finger will be heavier than his arm. And so that's what he told Jeroboam the next day, not listening to the old men of your race, but listening to all the Jews that moved in. The result was, to thy tents, to thy horses, O Israel, and Israel left. For the northern 10 tribes of Israel seceded from the throne of Judah, or David's throne in Judah, then in the hands of Rehoboam, leaving only Benjamin that stayed, as prophecy had declared it would at that time. You're all acquainted with the times and histories of individual battles. We mentioned some of that last week. In which the northern 10 tribes, carrying the captivity under Sennacherib, were released during the time of the great king Shalmaneser. Shalmaneser said, these people with their faith in one God, their wisdom, their knowledge, their great creative strength and genius, are a detriment to our land, for they're too wise to be our slaves, and someday we would be serving them. Let them go. So your race left under Shalmaneser's Emancipation Proclamation, which is on a big stone in the British Museum today. When they went through the Caucasian Pass, and they settled into Europe, coming up through the Iron Gate. They came, this Goths, Anglo-Saxons, Celts, Scandinavians. They each one settling their place produced the nations of Christendom. Judah and Benjamin later were conquered by Nebuchadnezzar, carried captive to Babylon in the stories of Daniel and the history of Daniel's denunciation of the evil of that Babylonian empire is well marked. For the fifth column that helped to destroy Jerusalem had come in the days of Zedekiah, the same bunch of evil forces, and was still dominating the throne line as they had in the days of Ahab, so were they in the days of Zedekiah. And Babylon was in their hand as well. And the influence over Babylon in the fifth column they had in Israel, or in the two tribes of Judah and Benjamin, lost the city of Jerusalem. And God had measured the time, and Jerusalem fell. The war of 586 B.C., continuing, climaxing in the great struggle in which Jerusalem fell to Nebuchadnezzar. Remember how in the days of Daniel the prophet, Belshazzar was on the throne, Nebuchadnezzar was dead, when Medo-Persia came against Babylon. Medo-Persia conquered Babylon, and after this, the peoples of Israel were carried into the land of Medo-Persia. Medo-Persia, while a cosmopolitan and somewhat Asiatic empire, had certain strong strains existing within it that were of better stuff. And a certain amount of assimilation of Upper Kurdistan peoples were involved in it. For instance, Artaxerxes was a very just and very excellent emperor over Medo-Persia. In fact, Nehemiah was the cupbearer to Artaxerxes, who was one of God's own prophets. And he was able to explain to Artaxerxes the fact that they had a great mission, and he was able to sell Artaxerxes on the fact that he should let Nehemiah and the tribe of Judah and Benjamin captive go back to Jerusalem and build again the city of Jerusalem and go back and establish their rights in their own land. So Artaxerxes let Nehemiah go. And Nehemiah gathered Israel, but when they went out of Babylon to rebuild it, some of these Jews, who even this man has to admit were Asiatic and Turk and Assyrian, went along. Now when they built again the city, it was in the days of Nehemiah, they built again the wall. They re-erected the temple. And this man said, the trouble just began. Woe, he says, to these terrible nationalists that always want to go back and build something. That's his word. He don't like nationalists because he's an internationalist. Then he said, then the Jews from Asia, the peoples of Judah and Benjamin who were Israel, and later the Hasmoneans and the Adumians of various households and all the battles that start in, he describes here. And they fight and they conspire for power and they burn down their temple and tear it up. And finally, they get a Jew who's called Herod and they make him king under the Roman Empire. And he builds a golden temple which was there during the days of Jesus. Now, the city of Jerusalem had now been built for the third time. When the time of Roman power extending over Palestine had developed and it had become a Roman province, this turbulent kingdom with Judah and Benjamin, or a large part of it, we settled in it, in the land of Judea and Galilee, was occupied with the greatest political force made up of Cathites, Jebusites, Moabites, and Canaanites of various kinds. These people were Sadducees. Their doctrine was from the Babylonian Talmud, which taught reincarnation and Sadduceeism as is taught by the Asiatic cults in India. Even this man admits that in his book. So we told you some of these things years ago, and this book's only out now just now about 4 weeks. 3 weeks. We saw our first copy last Friday. Let me tell you this. As a matter of interest, Jesus knew who these devils were. He meant just what he said when he said, "Ye of your father the devil," because he knew the race lines of devils that hadn't kept the first estate. More than that, he knew who true Judah and Benjamin were. He knew they were the sheep of his pasture. When he talked about other sheep that he also must bring, he was talking about the nations of Israel. When the high priest wanted to kill him, you remember the words of Jesus. We mentioned them to you last week. He told the high priest that the time would come when this city would be destroyed. Woe to this generation, he said. Not only did he tell them that, but he said the time would come when they asked him about his messiahship. He said he was the incarnate God. He said, "Thou hast said it," and he said, "You're going to see this incarnate revelation coming in the clouds of glory. And you're going to see the power of my kingdom when yours is all gone." Matthew tells us, the 26th chapter. And that made them even more furious to destroy him, because he not only declared his identity as deity, but he had also proclaimed the completion and the establishment of his kingdom in power and in glory. He had told the mason, who was the governor of Jerusalem, what he wanted to know. For Pontius Pilate, who had been educated in the Jewish universities of London, was married to Caesar's daughter. And that's how he got the job as governor of Jerusalem. But a man who had studied at the school of northern wisdom, a man who in his own racial background was a bad and was of Israel's stock. And when he saw Jesus, and when he had witnessed his presence, and he had already had a full report from all of his spies and all of his Roman operators in Palestine, he said, "This man hasn't done us any harm. I don't want to do anything to Jesus." He turned to Jesus and he said, "I want to let you go." Now he said, "What am I going to do with you?" He says, "I don't find anything wrong with you. Yet these people call for your blood." And Jesus said, "You do as it's written." He said, "Why don't you perform some great miracle? Then I'll have to let you go." Jesus said, he says to Jesus, "What is truth?" And Jesus gave him the answer that then so convinced Pontius Pilate that he was among the master of men that he surely didn't want to touch him at all now. Jesus said, "Pilate, you do just what is written." Then he explained to Pilate, his scribe Nicodemus records that it was written concerning his crucifixion and his resurrection. Strange it may be seen, after the ascension of Christ and the endowing of the kingdom with the Spirit of God, with vision and power, which was the great soul-conscious power of the mind of God descending upon them, which transformed Peter into an orator who had been a fisherman, and John into one of the greatest prophets of vision of the New Testament era. You remember that the hatred of the forces of evil were ever directed against Christian civilization. They sought to wipe it out. They used the insipid emperors of Rome, who they had helped to destroy with the debauchery they had introduced, Caligula and later Nero, to try to bring about their evil conspiracy. But each one of these things failed, with Christianity, even in the hours of its martyrdom, growing stronger, until the day came when Constantine marched down out of north and conquered southern Italy, and the kingdom of Rome became Christian. Now, strange as these parts of history are concerned, Titus the Roman in 70 A.D. marched out of Rome against Jerusalem. Jerusalem had been the greatest curse in the sight of Rome, for it controlled the economy from Pergamus, where they had their secret council, and Jerusalem, where they had their Sanhedrin, threatening, blackmailing, ruling Rome, pitting emperors against the people, and pitting provinces against one another, and pitting Asia and Assyria against Rome, and playing one off against the other, until the utter evil of it was so great that Rome said, "We're not going to stand for this." And so, Caligula dead, they sent Tiberius in. Or rather, sent in Titus the Roman conqueror. Titus the Roman marches. Now, in the years that preceded this, by several years, the tribe of Benjamin and the tribe of Judah, the real Israel stock, which this man has to agree was in Palestine too, and by now we're all Christians, mostly so. Then why should we stay here when Jesus, who they now accepted as Messiah, said, "This place is going to be destroyed"? Why should we stay here under the bondage of these even more increasingly evil people, and thus be under not only Jewry, but Rome also? So they migrated. They went round about and came up in their track and came through the Iron Gate too and settled. Here they come. Some of them by ship, but most of them by the long trail. And in comes the Goths and into Europe. Here they settle. Benjamin moving into Normandy, on up, some of them into Scandinavia, later some of them to migrate to Iceland, and a large portion of them staying in Normandy and in Scandinavia. Here comes the rest of the fifth Goth entrance that was to produce the lower Germanic houses and to occupy for a large part Czechoslovakia and Austria along with Germany. Strange as it might seem, it was only 2 years after the last of this migration had been consummated, according to history, when Titus the Roman besieged Jerusalem, smashed it up, threw it down, not a stone left upon another except a portion of the old Wailing Wall. The old wall of the temple, which you know today as the Wailing Wall. Now, most of these Jews were killed. Many of them fled the city, but large numbers of them in the invasion were killed. And Rome wiped them out for their evil. Now, in the question of feeling sorry for the Canaanites, Hittites, Jebusites, whatsoever they were, the fact is that their conspiracy they had sowed, they reaped. After Rome destroyed Jerusalem, the next one to enter Jerusalem in power and in majesty was Mohammed the Prophet. When the Mount Sinai of Arabia raised its head, it was the seer Mohammed. When the seer Mohammed raised his head, you'll remember that he marched down into Palestine, having already established the Mohammedan power over the areas of Esau, Ishmael. He marches down. When he came into Jerusalem, he said, "This is the site holy to our common father Abraham, and the land wherein the law was given, and here I will build a temple and dwell." But the Jews from Pergamus, and a few of the Jews of the state, had sneaked back into old Jerusalem, and there had set up a powerful Gestapo that ruled over the land to a certain extent out of the old ruins. But using the old building that had once been the Caesar's Praetorium, they were in positions of power when Mohammed went in the year 800. The time that he went in, you remember the Jews came forth and they said, "Maybe you're the Messiah." Now you remember that Jesus said, "I've come in my own name, you don't accept me. Another will come, I've come in the name of the Father, I've come in the name of Yah, I'm incarnate God, don't accept me. But anyone who comes in his own name, him you would accept." Of course, this wasn't referring necessarily to Mohammed, but it was referring ultimately to a wicked generation in the end of an age who would make an even alliance with the devil. But when Mohammed came in, they saw the armies of Mohammed. But they still had their old Jewish trickery up. What they planned for Mohammed is what they have done to others. What I think happened to Taft, what happened to Father Saul, what happened to Patton, what happened to the great French statesman who was opposing communism and who died a short time ago, they had mapped out another way for Mohammed. They said, we'll make an alliance and we'll set up a great banquet. And they rolled out their cloth of gold and set up their banquet. Mohammed was to sign a concord dot with them that the Jews could stay in Jerusalem, but they were going to build also a temple to Allah here. And so the Jews brought forth the great ceremonial cups and wanted Mohammed to drink of it. Well, Mohammed said, the high priest shall drink of it first. And the prior, he said, oh, no, no, it's not right. You drink first. Mohammed took a look at the high priest and drew that pretty jeweled dagger he had and says, you'll drink first. And the high priest tried to fumble the cup, but the cupbearer of Mohammed grabbed it, and Mohammed said, drink. And they poured it down the throat of the high priest, and he dropped dead. Well, there's no use explaining what happened thereafter, because instead of signing a concordat with the Jews that had gone back to Jerusalem, he just liquidated them. And that's why Mohammed's coming was called by the Jews a scourge. And there was a scourge to your race in Jerusalem when he came in at that hour, because it didn't affect you. But there was something that did affect you, because every white man of Anglo-Saxon, Scandinavian, Nordic, Basque, Lombard, and Germanic stock had something going on inside of him that said, I don't want anybody in Palestine. I want him. Palestine is ours. If others live there, they're not going to rule it. There is where Christ was born. There is where Christ was crucified. There's the birthplace of Christendom, and there's our old heritage, and we want it. Don't think the Knight Templars didn't know about us. They did. Don't think the men from London didn't know about us. They did. Don't think the men of Germany didn't know about it. They did. That's why crusades were fought, to get Palestine back. Then, my friends, the hand of Turkey still rested hard from Mohammedan days, from the loss of Constantinople on the east side over Palestine when World War I came along. Now World War I had its place in prophecy. God Almighty had promised that the land would go to Israel. He promised that it would be restored to Israel. And it was the house of Joseph that was to be the flame. And the book of Obadiah tells you about it. Strange enough, in that hour it was the 24th day of the ninth month, according to the prophet Haggai. And Daniel said, it'd be 1,335 years. He said, blessed is the man that comes to 1,335 days. And Daniel gave the measurement of a day for a year. When Mohammed set up his kingdom in Jerusalem and started the building of the Mosque of Omar, he named it Year One Mohammed. 1,335 years later, the British flag flew over the city of Jerusalem. Jerusalem, important. Important to more than one nation fighting in the war. You know what the Jews said? They said here that they started the war between Britain and Germany, economically and politically. It started up because they thought that it would weaken Christian nations and it would make it possible for them to get control of the state and set up a world headquarters there. And cited here, here's a volume that gives the history, tells how that they not only forced the signing of the Balfour Declaration, which they later misinterpreted, but they assured Britain, after she was involved in the war, which they admit they had engineered, here it is, they said that they promised Britain that if she would sign the declaration, that they in turn would use their influence to bring the United States, through their influence and propaganda, through Colonel House, they would use their influence to bring America into the war, World War I, and promise to finance the war to a successful conclusion. Now, when Kaiser Wilhelm was a young man, like every other German emperor of the Habsburg dynasty, he was given a theological education for 3 years. When that was over, he was ordained a Lutheran minister. And one of the things that they taught him as in that special training that was for the emperor, that the Lutherans had forgotten since and would do well to learn, they taught him that the Germans were the tribe of Judah. See, Hitler didn't start that, and the anthropologists in Germany didn't start it. You see, God started way back there when he told Judah that he was going to be just like he was. And history shows, and this man even admits it, that the Jews are not Judah, they're Cathars, Hittites, Amorites, and everything else that's evil. But the real Judah people were Germany. Now, Kaiser Wilhelm also was told, remember, you are a direct descendant of the tribe of David, because he had the same teaching that Queen Victoria had. After all, King George and Kaiser Wilhelm were cousins. So one of the things that King George, that the Kaiser said in Palestine before its fall in 1917, he had no idea that they were going to lose Jerusalem. He thought his alliances in the East, the power which he was manipulating in Africa, would be necessary and enough to hold it. He went out on the Mount of Olives and said, I'm going to build a castle right here, a palace. Now, he believed in prophecy. Strangely enough, the Kaiser Wilhelm didn't know all he should have known about the book of Zechariah, or he wouldn't have built on the Mount of Olives. But he said, I'm going to build here a palace, and I'm going to rule right here till Jesus comes. For I am of David's seed and of the house of Judah, and the scripture says, the scepter shall not depart out of Judah till Shiloh come, or Messiah. Now, what he didn't know was that when God transplanted the throne line from Judah to Israel, he set up David's house in the house of Joseph. And said, I dried up the green tree and made the dry tree to flourish. And that in the days when Jesus comes, that the administration of the throne of David will be in the hands of the Anglo-Saxons instead of the Judah house of Germany. So Judah and David in Joseph will rule rather than in Judah itself. So Kaiser Wilhelm said, I'll build my palace here. So he said, why did you say he never built this? If anybody wants to build a palace, don't build it on the Mount of Olives. But I got an idea. The other day, in the newspaper, they said that they hoped that they would move in the near future the United Nations headquarters to Palestine. I hope they do. And you know where I like to see them build their building? On the Mount of Olives. You say, why? Because the Mount of Olives is right where it should be built. You see, there's the biggest earthquake fault in history right underneath the Mount of Olives. And that United Nations is a Jewish conspiracy against all Christian civilization that stems out of communism and was sold to you as a bill of goods, and even Dulles doesn't know the difference. You see, you've been told not to make an alliance with the devil and to come out from among them and be separate and not to be tied up with evil. And you're trying to make the world good by joining the devil and letting him tie your hands and saying you can't win when you want to engage him in a conflict to defend your civilization. General Douglas MacArthur lost the war because the United Nations wouldn't let your Senate let him win the war. Let's face it. Now, let me tell you this about Palestine. I read this to you last week. I call it to your attention again if some of you were not here. King Saudi of Arabia just made a statement concerning Jerusalem, Palestine. He said that Israel is the cancer of the earth. He said that socialism and communism threaten the security of the world. That it conspired against all the Arabs and the Mohammedan peoples against Christendom, and it had dealt such a blow to prestige and to integrity in putting the Arabs out of their homes, in murdering their women and children, and in their filthy things they had done to the mosques. If they were to retain their self-respect, they had to wipe out this cancer from the face of the earth. So King Saud of Arabia said, I am willing to spend, and all the Arab world must join me, 10 million, yea, 50 million of our people, half of them of war, if necessary, to wipe Israel from the face of the earth. Times, Examiner, one of your own papers here, and now I've got about 27 clippings from my files around the country where it came up. So what's that got to do with it? I'll show you what it has to do with it. You see, King Saudi of Arabia said that the greatest invasion of violence the world has known, of rape and murder, was when the Jews came into Jerusalem, seized half the city, ravished its women, and destroyed its sanctuary. Now, one of the things that is important is this. In the scriptures, it says here, in the book of Zechariah, Behold, the time will come, the Lord said, when all nations will gather against Jerusalem to battle. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half of the city shall go into captivity. Now, that's your Jerusalem. You know how you got it. The pipeline that carried water from the River Nile so that the British soldiers and Allenby's Arabs of that side of the house would have water broke one day and ran down through the streets of the city. 3 days after the King George had told General Allenby, whose name in Arabic means God with us, to pray and wait for the fateful day of prophecy, the 24th day of the ninth month. Every hour, lay down his arms, surrendered the city to Britain on the 24th day of the ninth month, because in the Koran, which God permitted to be fulfilled for that hour, it said that they would never give up Jerusalem until water from the River Nile went through the streets. And when they found out what water was going through the streets, they just laid it down and walked out. Now, the Balfour Declaration was a high-pressure Zionist conspiracy. Now, I can tell you as much about Zionism and more than Mr. Lilienthal's book tells you, but it's nice for me to be able to tell you that this powerful left-wing Jew in the State Department, the Action-Hit crowd, also cites about Zionism, how it was organized by Herzl and others, and some of the men listed here are communists. And how we cite here that they organized it to establish world power, and fronting behind religion, we're going to build a power that was so great that it would rule the world and make Palestine the headquarters and establish dual allegiance for every Jew, which he's worried about because he don't want to lose his money and property in America. Now, Ben Gurion has given dual allegiance, and he even quotes Justice Brandeis here, who said, constantly referring to the Jewish race, that it didn't affect the citizenship of an American citizen to also be a citizen in the Jewish state because they were religious. Now, I'm going to tell you this, that in your time, you watched the blackmailing and all the record of that blackmailing. I've told you about it, held up the great ads when it happened, how they threatened America, they were going to give you a depression, and they boasted how they killed British soldiers and blew up hotels and all they were going to do to you if you didn't recognize Israel. They put that in your newspapers as a big ad, the American Jewish Committee. Why America didn't wake up and put these men in jail for conspiracy against the nation, I don't know. You know, there might be a good thing in getting this law bill passed. If anybody conspires to overthrow the nation or threatens to do it, ought to be thrown in jail and lose their citizenship. I think it's a good idea. As long as they interpret that conspiracy and overthrow the nation properly, don't direct it against any individual that opposes an administration. Let me tell you this. When the city of Jerusalem was taken, it was when, as you know, the Jewish army suddenly formed and were illegitimately landed on the shores of Palestine, armed with Russian and Czechoslovakian-made rifles and equipment, supplied with Russian submarines with more materiel through the years, landed on the shores of Palestine after the war. Some of the subs of which we turned over to them, which were German subs, turned over to the Russians. And then these hordes of Israel-Allied soldiers and gangsters, the Capone crowd, the Ergum, and the Haganah, the other Jewish army, marched in and seized the city of Jerusalem and did just what the scriptures said would happen in the end of the age when the city would be ravaged. And Jesus said, the abomination of the desolators will enter into the holy place. The abomination of the desolators came in when the Israel ally came in. For these Jews, even by their own admission, were behind wars and depressions and all these conditions to gain world trouble. They were the desolators, and now they came into Jerusalem and they desolated again. In fact, he admits in this volume that nothing they said Hitler did to them, and he curses Hitler, was any more than they did under their own nationalism, he said, to the peoples of Palestine. Now, when I used some white papers that were sent to me by the King of Egypt, they called me anti-Semitic. In fact, the Jewish Voice in Los Angeles accused us of being the most deadly racist anti-Semitic for reading the white papers from Egypt. And this man is saying the exact thing that the white papers said. Now, I'm going to tell you something. The city was taken. Half of the city went into captivity. Remember how half the city was free, the other half was down? So all the women, Protestant deaconesses from Protestant school or Greek Orthodox school, Catholic nuns, were raped and murdered. Their priests were murdered. The Arab women were murdered and their children thrown down the deep wells, the sea was rallied. We're not going to go into all the evil that they purported and put over. The cry and the result of Abdullah coming from Transjordan and reattacking and gaining positions of importance when the United Nations sabotaged him and all nations burdened themselves with Jerusalem and said, we'll have an armistice. And they demanded the Arabs keep it and the Jews keep it, and so they did. But the Jews were running the United Nations, where 1,823 out of 1,867 at that time were all Jews in its employ. By the way, last Friday's newspaper, the Jewish Voice, under Mr. Horowitz's column, said that it is very vital to them that the world realize that it's getting good news, that the Jewish world realize that all 150 newspaper reporters in the United Nations, four for Russia, so many for Britain, so many for Israel, so many for this nation, that all 150, name their names, who are the reporters that give all the world, the United Nations News, INS, United Press, every one of them are Jews, the names their names, every one. So you don't get anything but Jewish news out of the UN and Jewish slant, and they boast of it in last week's Jewish Voice. Now, do you remember when the Secretary General, an idealist that was but a tool, Bernadotte, went to Palestine? When he went to Palestine, he had sent home the documents day by day of what he saw, and we went over and partially investigated both sides. Even after they had violated the truce and pushed the Arabs out in the Negev, and they had used the weapons and supplies and tanks and equipment from Russia. When that happened, the Jews had him on the border in a small Jewish town, and they said to him, State Department officials, what has been your decision? He says, my decision is not individual. My information is cumulative. The United Nations, human relations, and its courts must make the decision. But I am convinced that the Arab cause is 90% right and that you're 90% wrong. The next day they shot him. Seized his document in his briefcase. And the world cried against Israeli allies' violence against this peaceful Count Bernadotte. And they said, the Irgun did it. Now the Irgun was supposed to be an irresponsible Jewish army, but it took its orders from Ben-Gurion. It did everything they wanted to do unofficial, but when they wanted a reward, they all pinned medals on them officially. And after it blew over, the whole Irgun was taken into the official Jewish army. Now afraid that it would affect his citizenship, Mr. Lilienthal, who wrote this book, wrote a little article that was in the paper, the Reader's Digest had it, The Flag of Israel Is Not Mine. You know what happened to him for writing that article? Joseph Pallas, head of the Jewish army in the United States, Haganah, called him up, contacted him and said, if you don't stop attacking what we are trying to do, we'll have you killed. Then later, the Haganah sent its officials to his house and said that they'd given his last chance, they're going to kill him. You know what I think? I think your nation is derelict indeed when it lets the Jews have an army in the United States that can threaten men and create acts of violence. They ought to all be in a concentration camp that's serving a foreign army. If you can lock up members of the Bunds, you can lock up Jews of Israeli ally. Listen. The God Almighty said, when this time comes, and half of the city goes into captivity as it did, then he says, I am going to fight for my ancient people, and I'm interested in this city. Now, the New Jerusalem is not there. You see, the city of Jerusalem is not the interest of Christ from the standpoint of Satan, this rejuvenation of evil. Christ's interest in the city of Jerusalem, that's the world turbulent spot of today, is to destroy it. Well, you say, that's not Christian. Yes, Jesus wants to destroy that city. Turn it up, split it in half, sink all Tel Aviv into the sea, flatten it out, and reconstruct the territory. Do it in one great earthquake. So he said, not only will I do this, but the Lord, in that day, he said here, He shall come, and he shall come first. When in the armies that we described last week were attacking Christian civilization, you know what happened the Monday after this speech? I mentioned it to you last week. The foreign ministers from Russia notified Israel allies that if the Arabs assault Israel, that they will come down, attack their oil fields, move their, you know, their countries in the back, and join in the defense of Israel allies. So America is doing something else, which pressure is demanding, and that Kermit Roosevelt influence factor is there. We've been arming Egypt and the Arab states as fast as we can to block some phony move on the part of the Russians. But as fast as we've armed the Arabs say we're getting spoiled up now to go run out to Israel allies. So the Jews in our papers last 2 weeks said, we're arming the Arabs to destroy Israel. And of course, Dulles and all the Jew friends that surround Mr. Eisenhower, Mr. Dulles, are disturbed. They don't know how to balance the thing. Of course, Eisenhower doesn't know anything. So we're faced with a strange picture this time. Now, Russia's going to come down, but Russia's also going to do something else, as your atomic scientist tells you this week in U.S. News. He says he's going to try a sudden attack on you while you're talking peace. And that's just what the Scripture says. When they say peace, peace, then comes sudden destruction. The Bible says that there is a new Jerusalem, but it's not going to be that one. It says here in Zechariah that this Jerusalem is going to be great and a multitude of civilizations. It's going to be cities without walls. Not one city, but cities without walls. A great, great nation, it says here. It describes it with capital and with wealth and with riches and with people that are all the children of Most High God. In fact, the book of Revelation, Jesus told John about a new Jerusalem. He says, you want to see the bride, the Lamb's wife, symbolic of communion, the congregations of God, and Jesus the Christ, the eternal God. And he shows me the new Jerusalem, a world order that came down from the days of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to our time. People of the living God. The city had 12 walls and 12 gates, and the gates, or 4 walls and 12 gates, and the names on the gates were the 12 tribes of the children of Israel. The great new Jerusalem is Christian civilization. All the nations that constitute it, in whom the Spirit of the living God lives, whose the city is made up of its populations, it's a great new land, and it fulfills its heritage accordingly. We haven't time to even finish that phase of the subject. We'll talk next week on the new Jerusalem. Let me show you something about this one. The Lord promised in this hour that the forces that occupied old Jerusalem, that were against his kingdom, and the powers of Russia, which are coming down in the 38th chapter of Ezekiel, were going to come against his land as they're going to come and try to take over yours, hitting simultaneously all the Christian nations of Israel. But as they move south, they're going to come and try to join with the Jews to dominate all North Africa and Egypt and the Mediterranean and move up into Europe. And strangely enough, America and Britain are going to have their part in that battle for Jerusalem. You say, why? Because you can't afford to let the Russians have it. That's one spot. That's what you think. Something else about it. America and Britain have an age-old heritage right down there. That's your land. So Almighty God said in that hour, when the great battle comes, and you're outnumbered, we talked to you about that last week. We said you were outnumbered 5 to 6 to 1. But God Almighty had a great reservoir of soldiers. In the 37th chapter of Ezekiel, he said that he had a reservoir of soldiers, 36th chapter. The 37th chapter, he said he was going to take America and Britain, the house of Joseph, and all the white Christian nations, their companions, and join them with Germany, Austria, and Czechoslovakia, and all the Christian nations, their companions, that were free to left to fight, make them one great powerful weapon, not one nation, but one powerful force, to stand off the armies of the enemy.